from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's forum. The Pulitzer Committee this year could not come to a decision on who ought to receive the award for fiction, but for poetry, they awarded it to a young Brooklyn-based Princeton creative writing professor named Tracy K. Smith, the author of three volumes of poetry, the most recent, a Grey Wolf Press published collection titled Life on Mars, which the Pulitzer Committee described as, quote, a collection of bold, skillful poems taking readers into the universe and moving them to an authentic mix of joy and pain, end quote. Author of Duende, which won the James Laughlin Award of the Academy of American Poets, and The Body's Question, winner of the Caveh Canem Poetry Prize. She has received awards from the Rona Jaffe and Mrs. Giles Whiting Foundation and is a protege in the Rolex Mentor and Protege Arts Initiative. And she joins us for this forum hour. And so pleased to have you here. Welcome.
Thank you.
I wanted my listeners to get acquainted with your poetry, which I find quite stirring and versatile, I might add. Before I ask you to read anything, as much as there's this versatility, you even have a villanelle in here and a sonnet, and you write politically as well as personally. There's a good deal of what I would call popular culture, even a quote from Rush Limbaugh. But the popular culture is also in the title of your book, David Bowie.
Yeah, absolutely. I guess a while ago I gave myself permission to let anything that was important or of interest to me as a person into my poems. I think before that I'd been operating under the idea that certain elevated material was what I should be concerning myself with in a poem, and that just felt a little bit false to me.
When did that come upon you, that you could be free that way?
I think it probably happened when I was in graduate school. You know, you're working so hard to please your classmates and please your teachers and maybe to live up to this idealized standard of what you imagine a poet is. And after a certain point, if you're lucky, I think that kind of breaks down and you realize that there's a private investment at stake as well. And that becomes most important.
Well, I think I read where you described poetry as being investigations for you.
Yeah, you know, I think of a poem as an opportunity to ask some questions and take my time in exploring possible routes toward an answer. Like, I don't even know if an answer is the most desirable endpoint, but the kind of exploration that a poem affords me is something that I really value.
As my listeners know, I'm a great believer in questioning, not necessarily with answers ahead of us. Could I get you to read one of your early poems in this collection? There's a whole second section devoted to your father, which I want to talk to you about. But I thought maybe we'd begin with It and Company, which is on page 17 in Life on Mars.
Sure. It and Company. We are a part of it, not guests. Is it us or what contains us? How can it be anything but an idea? Something teetering on the spine of the number I. It is elegant, but coy. It avoids the blunt ends of our fingers as we point. We have gone looking for it everywhere, in Bibles and bandwidth, blooming like a wound from the ocean floor. Still, it resists the matter of false versus real. Unconvinced by our zeal, it is unappeasable. It is like some novels, vast and unreadable.
Yeah, I was really moved by that, especially since it covers such an extraordinary swath of antecedents with a capital I. It reminded me of a supposed suicide note of W.J. Cash. Forgive me, but it did make me think of that, because his suicide note said, I can't stand it anymore and I don't even know what it is.
I found that as I was writing these poems, it, the pronoun it, just kept inserting itself. And I realized I was, you know, I was searching for a sense of what it was that I wanted to believe my father had gone into in terms of the afterlife. But it also became something, yeah, an antecedent, something that had to do with what's urging or pushing us along. And I couldn't get away from this placeholder. And so I decided I had to kind of give it some proper space and investigate it a little bit.
Let's talk about your father, because he plays such a preeminent role in this volume, especially in the second section, which is really an elegy for him. An engineer on the Hubble and someone who died back in 2008 and who came originally from black segregated Alabama. So to wind up being an engineer on the Hubble from those rather humble beginnings is sort of like going into outer space, really, isn't it?
I think so. Not that my father ever really phrased it like that for me when I was growing up. But when I look at the scope of his life now, it is really remarkable to me to see that that much history happened in such a short amount of time, actually, you know, to imagine that the living memory for people of his generation has gone through so many stark phases is pretty much like science fiction in some ways.
Tracy K. Smith with us, who is this year's Pulitzer Prize winner in poetry. Would you read The Speed of Belief, which is in memoriam for Floyd William Smith?
Sure.
Your father?
The Speed of Belief. I didn't want to wait on my knees in a room made quiet by waiting. A room where we'd listen for the rise of breath, the burble in his throat. I didn't want the orchids or the trays of food meant to fortify that silence, or to pray for him to stay, or to go then, finally, toward that ecstatic light. I didn't want to believe what we believe in those rooms, that we are blessed, letting go, letting someone, anyone, drag open the drapes and heave us back into our blinding, bright lives.
Yeah, that one gets me. and you read elegantly, by the way.
Oh, thank you.
I mean, a lot of poets don't quite have the intonation or the voice that you bring to this. Did your father get to know your work well? And did he give you the kind of feedback and appreciation one hopes for from a father one loves?
My father saw my first two books published. And I think that he became more comfortable in the world of my poetry. Not that I think he understood every single detail. My father was somebody who was more at home reading, you know, Longfellow or Wordsworth. And I think some of the tics of contemporary poetry were off-putting to him. And maybe that's one reason why some of my poems, or maybe many of my poems, seek to use language that's really familiar and transparent and to let the mystery of the poem happen under the surface.
But he was a reader of poetry.
He was. He was a reader of everything. I remember, you know, there's so many memories of my father with a book in his hand. Even I think there's one family portrait of us in which somehow my father is holding a book while the rest of us are smiling at the camera. So, yeah, he was somebody who was in love with words and where they could take him.
There's a poem you have in here called My God, It's Full of Stars, and that's actually from Arthur Clarke's novelization of 2001, A Space Odyssey. So, again, you're playing with, and I think playing is the right word, isn't it, with a lot of space metaphors in popular culture.
Absolutely. Yeah. I guess I was trying to figure out a few different things. When I first started writing these poems, I was thinking about America, and I thought that science fiction might be a helpful lens to think about some of the recent events or trends that I was interested in and maybe troubled by. And it seemed right to bring in high and low references. Like for me, Kubrick's 2001 would be a high reference. I think that film is so majestic. And then something that doesn't live up to that standard of beauty, like some of the Charlton Heston sci-fi films from the 60s and 70s also seem to want to fit into that wide screen gaze.
Yeah, I kept thinking about Mars Attacks by Tim Burton and The Face on Mars and Ray Bradbury's work and all those kinds of things were flooding my consciousness. But I also thought about what you communicate so well, which is the awe in the space, stellar canopy, heavens, the vastness of it, the impenetrability of it or unknowable mystery of it, but also the dark side, just of being human.
Yeah. I think the dark side came first for me. I was thinking, you know, socially, politically, as a citizen. And the largeness and the wonder was something that really pushed its way in. And I think largely that was a result of elegy becoming a mode that I needed to turn to. And suddenly, you know, this convenient lens that science fiction had provided gave way to something that really changed the scale of the questions that I was asking and asked me to maybe even look toward myself as opposed to at the headlines.
Well, you're willing to look inward in the old, often labeled confessional mode, which Garrison Keillor told me years ago should be retired. But also, you're willing to look outside. And I mean, there's a lot here about things like Abu Ghraib and crises in East Africa and the Austrian father who kept his daughter and her children in prison and sexually abused her. I mean, these are things that come into your poetry.
Yeah. Well, they're things that come into my point of view. You know, I read the newspaper, I listen to the radio, I'm bothered by the fact that I'm one way or another complicit in a world or society in which these things continue to happen. And
why do you say you're complicit?
I have this idea that, you know, not that I'm a proponent of that kind of like depravity, but I feel like when we live inside of our lives with comfort and allegiance to certain things that allow other things that we don't like to happen, we're complicit, you know. And I think that it's important to acknowledge that and maybe to start to question why it's so easy to be that way.
But you're also mindful, it seems to me, of just the beauty of some of these, well, and the humbling nature of some of the images we get back, say, from the Hubble.
Yeah. Those images to me are, they look like paintings, you know. They look exactly like something that the imagination, you know, invented to try and capture what space could look like. I see them and I can't not imagine something watching back or something that's capable of comprehending these large patterns that we haven't even yet recognized. It's kind of just splendid and
stunning.
Stunning, yeah. Stultifying, I was going to say, but yeah.
I was just being alliterative. You know, it happens to me sometimes when I have a poet. And the poet we're talking to, by the way, if you've just joined us, is Tracy K. Smith, and she's the author of Life on Mars and recipient of the 2012 Pulitzer Prize in Poetry. The universe is a house party. It's ours, you write. Which universe are we talking about? I'm reminded of an E. Cummings line, there's a hell of a universe next door, let's go. And we have all these universes now, don't we, to contend with?
I guess we do, yeah. Yeah, you know, I have to say that I think I've said this already, but when I first started thinking about space, it was really a way of imagining America. And I was kind of shocked at the way at the assumptions I made that the universe was an American place in a way. And I think that's where that poem, The Universe is a House Party, comes from. And I think it pokes fun at that sense of propriety.
You, in some ways, I suppose, poke fun at us, at our rather grandiose notions of ourselves when you say future that isn't what it used to be.
Yeah. I read on a blog somewhere that someone recognized that phrase from a bumper sticker, which is exactly where it came from for me. But some of those throwaway lines really do seem to capture our inability to articulate what we really feel in the face of big things. And I kind of like that.
Can you read another poem for us?
I'd love to.
How about, well, you pick it. The opening, I thought the opening was really interesting, the weather in space, before
okay.
we actually get into the collection.
Sure. The weather in space. Is God being or pure force? The wind or what commands it? When our lives slow and we can hold all that we love, it sprawls in our laps like a gangly doll. When the storm kicks up and nothing is ours, we go chasing after all we're certain to lose, so alive, faces radiant with panic.
Do you feel comfortable being called a metaphysical poet? Because you are.
Yeah, I do feel. I feel very flattered being called that. I think we're metaphysical people. We don't often enter into that vocabulary, you know, in phone calls, emails. But I think we live in that space a large part of the day. And certainly it's the space that we turn to when we feel the weight of large feeling.
But you write about what I would call very commonplace and quotidian things as well. You have a poem about walking a dog.
Yeah. I guess if I were a filmmaker, I would probably try and get all of these different images into film. And since poetry is the medium that I work in, I just try and let everything happen. And, you know, you can imagine a poem a collection of poems is something that's written over several years. And so a dog poem, comes along, and then a few months later, a more ambitious poem kind of knocks at the door.
Who are the poets that you continue to be influenced by in your own work or that have had a major impact on you?
I love and I hate that question, but
I love and hate to ask it, but I have to, yeah.
Yeah, of course. No. Someone recently said, okay, you have 1 second, name the one poet that you whose work you couldn't live without. And Elizabeth Bishop came to my mind, and that was a little bit of a surprise. But I find her work so incredibly masterful and lasting. Her poems don't ever feel dated to me. And she's just so gifted at looking at the world and describing it and allowing the details of things to bring with them a sense of emotional stake and possibility. And I think her work is something that's deeply American and extremely beautiful.
No, I agree with you about Bishop. I think she's terrific, and she's gone way up in the literary stock exchange. You have a poem on writer's block. What has experiencing writer's block for you been like?
Oh, gosh. I've gone through different kinds of writer's block. When I was a little bit younger, I went through a total shutdown that was anxiety produced. I think I was so, as I mentioned, workshop is something that you want to perform. And I think I got to a place where I just couldn't. And I stopped writing for several months and picked up photography as a way of trying to keep myself alive in an image-based medium. Now, thankfully, I think the writer's block that I experience is just slowness, slowness getting out of the blocks. And I think that poem that you mentioned, Alternate Take, is really an attempt to say, okay, this is slow going. Let's just record each step of the way and see what that might lead to.
Well, I'd like you to read another poem for us, if you'd be so kind. And there are a couple I know that you expressed interest in reading. One was The Universe's Primal Scream, which opened section 4 of your volume, Life on Mars. And another one was When Your Small Form Troubled Into Me, which is, which one would you like to read?
How about The Universe's Primal Scream?
Okay.
5 p.m. on the nose. They open their mouths and it rolls out, high, shrill, and metallic. First the boy, then his sister. Occasionally, they both let loose at once, and I think of putting on my shoes to go up and see whether it is merely an experiment their parents have been conducting upon the good crystal, which must surely lie shattered to dust on the floor. Maybe the mother is still proud of the 4 pink lungs she nursed to such might. Perhaps if they hit the magic decibel, the whole building will lift off and will ride to glory like Elijah. If this is it, if this is what their cries are cocked toward, let the sky pass from blue to red to molten gold to black. Let the heaven we inherit approach. Whether it is our dead in Old Testament robes or a door opening onto the roiling infinity of space, whether it will bend down to greet us like a father or swallow us like a furnace, I'm ready to meet what refuses to let us keep anything for long, what teases us with blessings, bends us with grief. Wizard, thief, the great wind rushing to knock our mirrors to the floor, to sweep our short lives clean. How mean our racket seems beside it, my stereo on shuffle, the neighbor chopping onions through a wall. All of it just a hiccup against what may never come for us. And the kids upstairs still at it, screaming like the dawn of man, as if something they have no name for has begun to insist upon being born.
Wow. Thank you for that. It's, you bring in a lot of the mystery of human behavior and yet the possibility of agency. And it made me think, of course, of Arthur Janov, who gave us the whole notion of the primal scream. Didn't you write some of the poems in this collection while you were pregnant?
I did. I wrote many of them. And, you talked about those mysteries. That was another big question in my mind. What am I in contact with right now with this person? Who is she and where has she come from? I guess those are questions that come up a lot when we think about pregnancy.
You knew she was going to be a she?
I did.
And she's given you a lot of joy.
She has, and she's changed my relationship to to everything in ways that I'm so grateful for, that I wouldn't have been able to wish for beforehand.
Changed you as a poet as well?
To be honest, I don't know yet. I know that the questions that I have feel like they weigh something different with her in my life. And so I imagine that means my poems might be going after different kinds of things. But I've been working on prose since she's been born for the most part. So I don't know exactly what it's going to feel like to go back into the poetry bubble with this other person in my world.
Is it too soon for you to talk about what prose you're working on?
Well, I'll talk a little bit about it. It's a memoir that takes up I guess some of the things my poems in this book talk about in terms of family. I grew up in California in the 70s and 80s.
Where?
And Fairfield.
Oh, close and, by. Yeah.
Yeah, not far from you. And so thinking about the family that I was a part of and the relationship that I had to my parents' history. And now I also realize that race and religion were large questions that I didn't quite know that I was wrestling with at the time, but that I'm having a really interesting time moving back toward in prose.
How influenced were you by, say, African-American poets? I mean, not only contemporary, but, you know, going back to Langston Hughes and Claude McKay and Jean Toomer, those poets?
Mm-hmm. Well, those were poets whose voices I loved hearing. I loved reading their poetry aloud. And, you know, in literature classes, I loved, you know, analyzing those poems and thinking about the way that sound and history and tradition were being utilized and also pushed against or questioned. Those are not the voices that I feel that my writing is seeking to channel in terms of the voices that have taught me how I want to put words down on the page, but they've opened doors of possibility that I have to acknowledge.
Well, there's been an ongoing, I suppose, call it division about the purpose of poetry or literature from the black perspective, many saying it has to be political, and that was especially true during the 60s and 70s. And, Ralph Ellison probably said it best, if I wanted to be a sociologist, I'd write sociology, meaning I'm an artist above all. Do you take a stand on that?
Well, I feel very free in terms of, you know, there's no obligation that I bend to. But I also feel that the issues that confound me as a human are things that I really want to think about in my poetry. And race plays a role in that, in as much as the way that we as people treat one another is a big theme in my work. I love that as an African-American poet, I have the opportunity to write about race and make overt connections to other writers who have done the same thing. And I also feel like I'm now in conversation with writers who are of different backgrounds who might be thinking about the same theme. Tony Hoagland is a white poet who has written a lot of poems about race, some of which are very contentious. But I think that conversation is something that we now feel more comfortable saying everyone's invited to. And I think that's something that is really characteristic of this particular moment in American poetry.
I'm going to ask Tracy, if you would, to read that poem I alluded to before, When Your Small Form Troubled Into Me.
Sure. It's actually When Your Small Form Tumbled
Into Me. Excuse me. Yes. That was a strange Freudian slip. But
I use the verb troubled a lot with my students, so I think that's okay. When Your Small Form Tumbled Into Me. I lay sprawled like a big game rug across the bed, belly down, legs wishbone wide. It was winter, workaday. Your father swung his feet to the floor. The kids upstairs dragged something back and forth on shrieking wheels. I was empty, blown through by whatever swells, swirling, and then breaks night after night upon that room. You must have watched for what felt like forever, wanting to be what we passed back and forth between us like fire, wanting weight, desiring desire, dying to descend into flesh, fault, the brief ecstasy of being. From what dream of world did you wriggle free? What soared and what grieved when you aimed your will at the yes of my body, alive like that on the sheets?
That's a pretty sexy poem. I like it. Listener called in a minute ago and said, is she a product of the California public schools? You are, aren't you?
I absolutely am. Yeah.
And how do you think the schools did for you as far as teaching language and poetry or approaching a literary education?
I feel really lucky. I remember so many teachers that were just wonderful in terms of giving us access to great literature and giving us a sense of agency and wisdom. I remember, I was in the fifth grade and writing a poem in response to maybe a Mark Twain story that I had read. And my teacher said, that's important. And that's a good poem. You have something to say. And I think I never let go of that bit of encouragement and never stopped thinking that I was somebody who had a voice that I should use.
Are you going to use that in conjunction with the Pulitzer? I mean, in other words, really what I'm getting back to some of the poet laureates like Bob Haas and Kay Ryan, who both happen to be from this area as well, mm-hmm. who felt it was almost their obligation, really, to teach not only youngsters to be apprised of poetry and its delights, but also to give them an opportunity to express themselves through poetry.
I think it is really important. I love, and not just youngsters, I taught a poetry workshop for senior citizens recently who didn't consider themselves writers and was just so inspired and delighted by the stories that they had and the sense of memory that they were able to access. I think poetry is something that we really and truly can't or shouldn't live without. I think it affects us as individuals and as citizens, and I do feel like that's something, a mission, I'd like to take on to make sure that there are more people who come in contact with this thing that's of such importance.
You've been listening to a special encore edition of Forum. Our guest was poet Tracy K. Smith. We spoke to Smith shortly after she won the 2012 Pulitzer Prize for her collection of poetry, Life on Mars. Forum is produced by Judy Campbell and Irene Noguchi. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai, with online support from David Marks. Senior editor is Dan Zoll, and executive producer is Raul Ramirez. I'm Michael Krasny. Happy New Year.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.